This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson. President Trump is wrapping up a nearly two-week trip to Asia. After stops in Japan and South Korea, he went to Beijing, to Vietnam, and the Philippines. After meeting with leaders of five of America's top trading partners, Mr. Trump has yet to spell out a clear strategy for how his administration plans to move U.S. interests forward in that region. Since President Trump withdrew the United States from the Trans-Pacific Partnership, one of his first acts as president, many business, political, and trade experts have expressed concern that pulling out of that trade deal will let China take the lead. Joining us in studio to talk about America's role as a trading partner in Asia is Sean Donnan, World Trade Editor covering international economics for the Financial Times. Sean, welcome to 1A.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us is Mary E. Lovely. She's a professor of economics at Syracuse University and a visiting fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics. Professor Lovely, welcome.
Glad to be here.
And joining us online from Sheffield, Massachusetts is Michael Stumo, the CEO of the Coalition for a Prosperous America. Michael, glad to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
Sean Donnan, let me start with you. How would you characterize, related to trade issues, how would you characterize the message the president delivered to the Asia-Pacific region over the last week and a half? What's the big headline?
So this is a regular trip that presidents make out to Asia for two big summits that happen out there. But obviously, we had a lot more scrutiny this time around because this is Donald Trump's first trip out there, and he is Donald Trump. And his message was on the trade side was twofold. Is one, we want to do business with you, but we want to do business on our terms. And secondly, we are really out to rewrite the system and rewrite the way trading rules are written and how they're abided by around the world. He's building on a theme that was this big economic theme during the campaign, which was trade has hurt a lot of America, and we need to fix that.
He certainly built on that theme last week in Beijing. Here's a clip of the president speaking there.
Both the United States and China will have a more prosperous future if we can achieve a level economic playing field. Right now, unfortunately, it is a very one-sided and unfair one. But I don't blame China. After all, who can blame a country for being able to take advantage of another country for the benefit of its citizens? I give China great credit.
That was President Trump speaking last week in Beijing. And Sean, that seems to follow on a theme that the president's had since the campaign, that the U.S. is being treated very unfairly in multinational trade deals like the Trans-Pacific Partnership that the president pulled the United States out of. How does that message play broadly through this Asia trip? We heard people in the hall laughing. I don't know if they were laughing uncomfortably or if they were laughing like, yeah, you're right. Like, how did that play?
Well, so there's a bit of both, right? I mean, they out in Asia are still trying to figure out what to make of the Trump administration, as we are here in the U.S. But the big theme that you hear there is it's, you know, really the U.S. Has been a dupe through recent decades, that it has engaged in the trading system, that it has gone out and signed these trade deals to its own detriment, and that somehow this has hurt the U.S. economy. And that is the complete inverse of what most economists argue. It's a complete inverse of what most presidents have argued over time, and that is that engaging with areas like Asia really helps build prosperity here at home. So we're hearing a kind of rewriting of the rhetoric by Donald Trump here. The big question going forward is, what is the U.S. role going to be in setting the rules for the global economy? So globalization is a phenomenon that's been going on for two millennia. It is it's something that will be there for another millennia or two to come. The question, what trade agreements are about, is writing the rules for that, kind of controlling how that phenomenon affects your own economy, protecting certain sectors, opening up other sectors, creating competition in the system, so you get more dynamic economies, and so on. And Donald Trump is arguing that what the U.S. has been doing since 1944, 1945, after World War II, has been building a system that actually hurts America.
Michael Stumo, let me come to you. First of all, your organization, the Coalition for a Prosperous America, how would you describe that organization's focus, what it is, what it does?
Sure. We have manufacturing, agriculture, and organized labor in our organization. We have supporters in every district except seven congressional districts, that is. We have a focus on the trade deficit. We're very concerned about the trade imbalance in which persistent trade surplus countries like China, Germany, Japan, Korea overproduce, underconsume, and export their overcapacity and their unemployment to deficit countries like the U.S. So when the middle of the country between the coasts is disillusioned with the current global trading system, we think it's the imbalance that is harming the jobs in middle America, the working class jobs, mm-hmm. and financing the rise of China and other countries.
I wonder then, Michael, if I could get you and Professor Lovely to respond to this tweet from Gemma. Gemma tweeted, "What was the goal of this trip and what did this trip accomplish?" Michael, what do you think was the goal and the accomplishment of this trip?
Of course, the trip covered a lot of issues, but as to trade, President Trump outlined, if you actually read his APEC speech, a large portion of it is, in fact, dedicated to trade and the administration's view on trade going forward in a very detailed way. The reason people are confused is because he doesn't speak of it in the way that is usually done in the cocktail parties and international gatherings. It's a new vision, expressing concern that we opened our borders and others didn't. Other economies use economic nationalism to their advantage, and we're catching up, and that President Trump is going to start a new effort to rebalance the relationship. And in fact, that is the whole goal of the WTO system, reciprocally and mutually advantageous arrangements on trade. The IMF charter is for the balanced growth of international trade.
So, Michael, I want to make sure I don't miss your answer to Gemma's question. Do you think that the goal and the accomplishment was just expressing this disdain on behalf of the United States government? I mean, is that what you think, or was there more to it?
The goal was to show where the Trump administration is going in the future for focusing on bilateral agreements and to lay out the itemized list of where the imbalance has occurred, whether it's intellectual property, currency manipulation, subsidies, okay. and that the U.S. intends to address them.
Professor Lovely, what about you? What did you think the goal of this trip was, and what did the trip accomplish?
Well, the trip had many goals, including on trade and investment, but I think we still are forming an overview of what the Trump administration will do to address the issues that it sees as crucial for America. The statement by Michael that other countries have pursued economic nationalism, I think, is true in some cases. I think where we really differ is what the best U.S. response to that type of behavior really is. For example, I think that many people look at bilateral trade agreements like, say, the Korea-U.S. trade agreement as negative for the U.S., but in fact, the Korean tariffs fell much farther than U.S. tariffs. So the U.S., in that sense, won through the agreement. So really the issue is how do we engage and whether the idea of going bilateral as opposed to multilateral is likely to be a productive strategy. I would argue that it isn't. It isn't a way to close the trade deficit, which I agree with Michael has to be addressed. And I don't think it's going to be a productive way to address a whole host of issues that the United States would like to address in terms of promoting our economic and commercial interests abroad.
We're speaking to Syracuse University economics professor Mary E. Lovely, also a visiting fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics, Michael Stumo, the CEO of the Coalition for a Prosperous America, Sean Donnan, the World Trade Editor covering international economics for the Financial Times, and with you. We welcome your questions and thoughts about the president's Asia trip, including on trade. Perhaps you are feeling the impacts of trade with Asia in your line of work, whether you are in import-export or in retail or manufacturing, or you're just noticing it in your community, that the way we deal with trade with Asia directly affects you. We'd love you to share what you know about trade with Asia and how it hits your bottom line. Email us, 1A@WAMU.org, tweet us at 1A, or comment on our Facebook page. Sean?
Yeah, so I think there's a couple of things that we need to think about. First of all, is that Michael and the case that he lays out for that Donald Trump lays out for tackling the trade deficit is something that most economists argue is just not the right metric to tackle. The trade deficit that the U.S. has run consistently with the world since the late 1970s has as much to do with the fact that a lot of people want to invest money in the United States as it does with what we trade with the rest of the world. There's no doubt, however, that globalization creates a lot of churn in economies and that a lot of people have been affected. But that churn is not always about trade. It's also about automation. It's about the way, our tastes change.
And when you say churn, you mean gaining jobs, losing jobs, moving
gaining
jobs.
Gaining jobs, losing jobs, et cetera. So there's some really great research that's been put out by David Autor, who's an economist at MIT, and some of his colleagues about the impact of China joining the WTO on the U.S. economy. And he comes up with a number that roughly 2 million jobs over about a decade were lost here in the United States as a result. But he also points out, if you interrogate that a little further, that's roughly equivalent to the monthly churn in the U.S. Labor market, the number of people who quit jobs and find new jobs as well. So it sounds like a big number, 2 million. But in the bigger context, when we have 100 million plus people in the U.S. economy, it's just not that huge.
So it's kind of the cost of doing business.
It's the cost of doing business, but it's not just about international trade. So Michael's sitting up in Massachusetts right now. I'm an Australian who sounds like an American, but I spent a lot of my life in Massachusetts. I guess that makes me a bit of a globalist. But if you think about New England, it peaked as a manufacturing power in the 1880s. And one of the reasons it is no longer the manufacturing power that it used to be, that you have a lot of mill towns, former mill towns in Massachusetts that no longer are manufacturing centers, is because that manufacturing moved out into what we now call the Rust Belt in Ohio. It moved south into North Carolina and South Carolina and states like that. So economies evolve. Things change.
Michael, let me let you jump back in.
Sure. The view that it's inevitable, globalization is inevitable and we're just going to be losing jobs on net isn't true. The issue is how we manage globalization. And the other trade agreements are indeed almost irrelevant. We have trade agreements with 18 different countries. If you look across those agreements, it's very hard to find cause and effect that really worked. Hey, this worked. Let's do it again consistently. We have enough data that we should find a cause and effect, and we can't. The way China, Japan, and Korea dug themselves out of poverty and became, first-class manufacturing, increased income, Japan and Korea became first-world countries, is focusing on a mercantilistic economic nationalist system to focus on production and to grow their productive abilities. They didn't do it through trade agreements. They did it through unilateral action, which included, in most cases, undervaluing their currency. This whole churn issue that, winners and losers, people don't believe that anymore. We've lost a lot of jobs on net, and it's giving rise to a real big disruption in the Western economy political systems. People just don't buy it anymore. And investment and savings doesn't cause net trade to go down. Michael Pettis has a great book called The Great Rebalancing that describes how the mercantilism of China, Korea, Germany, and others, they use their internal policies to create their overcapacity and export that overcapacity and unemployment to other countries. And we import it. So the investment savings argument is just false.
Can we bring this down a little bit away from the 14-letter words like overcapacity and mercantilism? And no, I don't know if it's 14 letters, but it's more than 10. Can we make this a little bit clearer what this means to me on Main Street? I feel like often these conversations about trade get really wonky, and I'm so glad to be with three wonks who understand this. Thank you all for making time for us. But I'm still a little confused as to how mercantilism affects whether I get a job or not. Professor Lovely, bring this down to earth. What happens in Vietnam, China, South Korea, the Philippines, Japan, for someone who's here in the U.S. who's worried about whether or not their job is going to stay or the factory is going to close or whether, the industry that their granddad did is still going to be here for me? Paint me a clear, solid line from what happens with the president overseas to what happens right here on Main Street. Give me an example.
Oh, I'd be happy to do that. Sean said he spent a lot of time in Massachusetts. I grew up in Rhode Island, so of course I'm very familiar with the movement of factories to the South, as well as to the Midwest. I also have children who are college age, one of whom is not going to go to college. So I'm very concerned about what's going to happen to the younger generation. And I understand the anxiety that's out there. I think the American people are smarter than thinking that, you know, slapping a few tariffs on Korea or China are going to fix our problems. Robert Z. Lawrence has recently shown that if you just looked at the decline in manufacturing employment in the U.S. from the 1960s, say stop at the end of the 80s, and then just kept drawing that line, you would be exactly where we are today. And so it's the same forces that are leading to the decline in manufacturing jobs, not manufacturing output, by the way. Output has been very healthy, which shows you that it's productivity. American manufacturers are producing more dollars for each person than before.
So output has gone up, even though the jobs have gone down.
Exactly. And we expect that this process will continue and maybe even accelerate as more companies adopt robotics and other types of advanced manufacturing techniques.
So what does Asia have to do with that?
Asia can be a market for many of our goods. Asia can also be a market for new types of technology. For example, we think about the iPhone. The United States has gained a lot in terms of jobs, profits for American investors, American pension funds, and yet Apple is not an American manufacturer. They're in a different category. We have to ask, what kind of jobs do we want our children to have? Personally, I'd like my children will almost certainly be in the service sector in one way or another. I'd like them to have a job that is export-based, perhaps, or domestic-based. It doesn't matter as long as it carries with it the types of wages and benefits that Americans want. I think the focus on they're doing this to us takes us away from thinking about what do we need to do to make our economy strong.
Bootstraps tweeted, "Yes, kiss up to Putin and Xi to denuclearize the DPRK, North Korea. It's our last shot to accomplish this sans war. So many fools only see trees. It is strange how many can't see the forest. Trump is picking his battles. What is the most important item on the agenda? The DPRK." What about that? I mean, the president also spent a fair amount of this time, including his address to South Korea's government, talking about North Korea. Should we be viewing this as purely a trade visit, or was this a trade visit with a larger purpose? We'll get more into that and get into more of your questions as we continue dissecting the president's trip to Asia. Stay close. Back now to our conversation with Sean Donnan of the Financial Times, Syracuse University economist Mary Lovely, and Michael Stumo of the Coalition for a Prosperous America. Michael, I'd love you to chime in on that in terms of the kinds of jobs we need to develop for the future, how these big trade deals address or don't address that piece of the argument, particularly in light of what Nicholas in Arlington, Virginia wrote. Nicholas writes, "U.S. corporations sold out American workers. China didn't take our factories. Corporate America took their trademarks and decided cheap labor and profits were more important than being a good corporate citizen." Michael, how much of this do we put on these multilateral deals as opposed to putting it just on corporate America trying to do business on the cheap?
Sure. Well, most of it is the U.S. unilateral disarmament, opening our markets and trade, and other countries didn't. When China joined the WTO and got permanent low tariffs with the U.S., that gave them the certainty for not only the U.S. multinationals to move there, but also for the Chinese Communist Party to invest very aggressively in state-owned enterprises in production there to target the U.S. market. And so during that time, we had the biggest offshoring wave in the history of the United States. So the China accession to the WTO was a pretty big deal. It combined with their continued undervalued currency, their continued subsidies, their continued, you know, every five-year state economic plan. And so that was a big deal. The rest of the trade agreements are sort of a wash. They don't really treat the underlying causes of the imbalances. And that's why the U.S. can actually engage in some unilateral strategy ourselves without the trade agreements to to get back to balance so that we can create jobs. And manufacturing is pretty important. I know, Mary, you did track a decline from the 60s, but the U.S. economy is about 10% of the economy, 10 to 12 is manufacturing. But the surplus countries like Germany have 25, Korea has 39%. You need a balance in your economy. You need more manufacturing. And by the way, the 66% of the people don't have workers, don't have a college degree. You've got to find something for them to do, and successful countries do. We don't, and it can't just be part-time, low-wage service jobs.
Actually, since you brought that up, I've mentioned this in the program before, but we did, not to take away from your point, Michael, we did a program a few months ago about how to earn six figures without a college degree in some of these new careers that don't require a typical baccalaureate degree, but that pay very well and are in the vanguard of particularly advanced manufacturing, jobs you can get or start to get right now. You'll find that program on our website, the1a.org. That's the word the number one, the letter a.org. But Michael, just to be clear, corporate America, where's that role in the current decline in manufacturing jobs? They bear some responsibility, don't they?
They do. And in fact, they're always looking for the cheapest place to invest in their production and then ship their product to wealthy consumers. What the trade agreements should be viewed more as investment agreements. So when you have a permanent ease of access to the wealthiest consumer market in the world, like the U.S., they will invest there. In the case of Mexico, that happened with the maquiladoras after the peso crisis in 1994. In the case of China, I just described it. But as to Japan, Korea, Germany, they don't have an offshoring problem to China or the low-wage world. They work very hard to keep the crown jewels of a diverse manufacturing supply chains in their country, and that is why they grow on the world stage and we stagnate.
Let me get to a few more of your comments. Bootstraps tweeted, "Yes, kiss up to Putin and Xi," referring to Chinese President Xi Jinping, "to denuclearize the DPRK, North Korea. It's our last shot to accomplish this sans war. So many fools only see trees. It's strange how many can't see the forest. Trump is picking his battles. What is the most important item on the agenda? The DPRK." Sean, what do you think? Was this trade trip really kind of trade on the side, but mostly we got to talk about North Korea? That was that big speech he gave in South Korea where he said, "Do not underestimate us and do not try us."
Absolutely. There were two big purposes to this trip, or two big items on the agenda. One was trade and economics, and the other one was North Korea and building some alliances with Japan and South Korea and China. He was also talking about it in Vietnam, and he was talking about it in the Philippines again today, trying to get people on board with this idea of we need to isolate North Korea further. But the two pieces are interlinked. Trade and economics and trade agreements have also always been about building strategic relationships. The agreement that the U.S. Put in place with South Korea in 2012 was about solidifying an economic relationship, building a stronger alliance there, and so on. And the big question for this administration is how it treats those alliances. When it pulled out of the Trans-Pacific Partnership, when President Trump pulled out of the Trans-Pacific Partnership in January, he was pulling out of what was the biggest strategic project that the Obama administration had in the region. That was about setting up not just stronger alliances with Japan and countries like Vietnam, but it was also about getting in the way, or responding to some of what Michael has been talking about, which is the rise of China and how state-owned enterprises operate there. These are these big kind of government-backed behemoths that produce steel and kind of export out into the world. The TPP, for the first time, brought into an agreement rules for state-owned enterprises. And it was about kind of getting out ahead of China in writing the rules for the region. When Donald Trump pulled out of that, he gave up that space to other people.
So because so many of the large enterprises in China are state-owned, this would have made what you're saying is this would have made a huge difference in terms of creating some kind of global rules so China couldn't just run the table unilaterally.
Absolutely. China was not part of the TPP. It had expressed interest in joining at some point, but they were using kind of Vietnam and other countries like Malaysia as a proxy. These places have big state-owned enterprises as well, often in the resource space, and they were using them to kind of build these rules and get out ahead of China.
Now, I wonder maybe, Professor, if we need to dig a little bit more into the Trans-Pacific Partnership. B wrote on our website, the populist wave that swept TPP away on the right and the left, as Bernie and Hillary also promised to scrap it, was a sad day for the U.S. economy. The trade pact would have integrated many Asian countries into our trade network and forced them to adopt higher labor and environmental standards. In short, we stood to make money and create jobs. Those who believe this was the right move, why? Professor, what do you think that the nation missed out on, particularly in some of this populist wave? Because let's remember, Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton all eventually came out against the Trans-Pacific Partnership. What do you think that we missed in the furor over that?
Yes, there certainly was a political failure of will or courage on TPP. But I agree with Sean that it is about alliances, both political as well as economic, when it comes to TPP. And that by pulling out of TPP, America really ceded its leadership role in advancing the types of issues that Sean was talking about. Disengagement is a ceding of leadership just by definition. So it means that the U.S. will not be able to lead on issues like labor rights and labor standards, environmental performance, opening up foreign markets to U.S. service exports, certainly how we're going to treat state-owned enterprises in the global economy, and that is going to be vitally important moving forward.
Sean?
I think there's, you know, just to bring it back to Main Street in the way that you were talking about, all of those things are about protecting jobs and creating jobs in the U.S., and I think that's important. If you have higher labor and environmental standards in Vietnam, that makes it harder for them to compete by you know, doing more pollution or creating things in a way or producing things in a way that we wouldn't accept here in the United States. So that's where this kind of global rules-making thing is important.
Andrew emailed, "Say what you want about Trump, but he has changed the debate about China and its exploitive trade policies. There is no equal playing field. China restricts their markets, restricts intellectual property, and exploits numerous World Trade Organization loopholes. Those who criticize changing our policy towards China are simply being alarmist at best and disingenuous at worst." And S&B says at our website, the1a.org, here's a summary of Xi Jinping's address at APEC. "Come one, come all. China is open for business." A summary of Donald Trump's address at APEC. Buzz off. No prizes for guessing who the nations of Asia will deal with. Michael, I'd like to get a little more into the message that the president sent during his trip to APEC at the CEO summit in Vietnam. Here is a clip of the president talking about a renewed trading partnership with countries in the region. And again, he's not talking about multinational deals. He's talking about making deals between countries one-on-one.
When the United States enters into a trading relationship with other countries or other peoples, we will, from now on, expect that our partners will faithfully follow the rules just like we do. We expect that markets will be open to an equal degree on both sides, and that private industry, not government planners, will direct investment. Unfortunately, for too long and in too many places, the opposite has happened.
That was President Trump speaking during the Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation's CEO Summit, the APEC CEO Summit in Vietnam. Michael Stumo, what do you think are the pieces of these bilateral deals, these one-on-one deals, that have to be in place for our trade with Asia to benefit us here at home?
I actually think bilateral deals is somewhere where we would diverge with the president. We don't think the bilateral deals are the answer. The multilateral deals with TPP are not the answer. The tools that cause China's rise when they grew 16% in the 90s, you know, 8-10% in the first year of this century and to continue outgrowing us, they were not about trade agreements. It was about a focused strategy on production and employment and wage growth there. They did a good job of it.
Let me back up. So you don't like the one-on-one deals. You don't like the multinational deals. What kind of trade deals are you advocating?
Well, the implicit in your question is that trade deals matter. They really don't matter very much.
Because
current for trade imbalances, whether your exchange rate or your currency is undervalued, is what causes you to have a trade surplus. If you're overvalued like the U.S., you have a trade deficit. If you If you combine that with strategic subsidies for high tech industries to improve your composition of trade, that's a big deal.
So you're saying we should just ignore trade deals for now? I mean, what should we do?
Exactly.
No trade deals at all?
There is no cause and effect with trade deals across the 18 countries we have them, where we have improved trade performance. Our trade performance was better prior to the modern trade agreement era. And they're very fashionable, and it's against the cocktail party conversation, but they're virtually irrelevant as a macro scenario for employment.
So I want to make sure I'm really clear, Michael. So the president is talking about getting rid of the multinational deals and doing one-on-one deals. Do you think there is anything that he can bake into these one-on-one deals that would make them beneficial to the U.S., or do you think the president should just stop making these deals altogether?
Stop making them and focus on addressing the mercantilism of other countries through currency, state-owned enterprises, subsidies, and the like unilaterally, because those deals do not have positive benefits in a consistent way. We've been sold. We're writing the rules on trade with NAFTA and all the trade deals and the China accession to the WTO. It's never worked. They were trying to sell us on labor rights and environmental standards and SOEs. For the TPP, labor groups opposed it because the labor rights were insufficient. Environmental groups opposed it. Those lawyers who fight the SOEs in trade enforcement cases opposed it because it was
SOEs?
All a charade.
SOEs?
State-owned enterprises.
Thank you.
Everyone who supports labor rights, environmental standards, and addressing state-owned enterprises opposed the TPP because they were a charade.
Let me let Sean Donnan back in the conversation before we're out of time. I do take Michael's point in terms of concerns about labor standards. That
absolutely
was something that came out when the arguments against the Trans-Pacific Partnership.
No, absolutely. The TPP was opposed on the left. It was opposed on the right. But I think what Michael is moving towards, and I don't want to put words in his mouth, but he is part of a school of thought here in the United States that argues that we should have greater protection for U.S. industry, that there should be tariffs, that the U.S. should be using muscular.
That's not my position.
Well, but you should be using much more muscular, I think you'd argue, a much more muscular trade policy to respond to what is cheating in your mind by the Chinese. And I think there's consensus absolutely that on both sides that China's rise hasn't always been managed well by the United States. At the same time, there's a big question as to whether or not the U.S. could have really managed China's rise.
I know we're low on time. Professor Lovely, where does this go from here? Now that the president is getting ready to come back from Asia, what's the next step, briefly?
Well, I was surprised to hear Michael say he doesn't think that the bilateral approach taken by the administration would be helpful. I certainly agree with that. I think right now we're going to be in a period where we're really not going to be moving forward in any way. We actually have kind of an absence of a U.S. presence, and we're going to have to look for other countries to step up. We saw this over the weekend with the, I won't say quite completion, but almost completion of the TPP-11. So other nations are seeing the benefit of joining together in like-minded ways to move forward with an inclusive agreement that addresses a number of these higher order issues like state-owned enterprises and subsidies. So I think the rest of the world will move on without us. I think the rest of the world would be better with U.S. participation in it. It certainly would be more valuable to us. I think we run the risk of being locked out or just not being able to take advantage of the opportunities that are going to come from these agreements.
And what we've seen throughout this trip is that the countries that Donald Trump wants to engage with bilaterally just aren't ready to have that conversation yet.
And Michael, briefly, where does this go from here? What's the next step?
The next step is we will see what happens with the Trump 232 investigations, which are trade enforcement investigations on aluminum and steel, on a 301 investigation in terms of a broad-based investigation on Chinese theft of intellectual property and forced technology transfer. And that's where the focus is going to be. There will be challenges at the WTO, probably, to these, also to China's market economy status, which is a big deal. So we will see more challenges to the WTO system in the future as the U.S. uses more domestic trade laws to rebalance things.
That's Michael Stumo, CEO of the Coalition for a Prosperous America. Michael, thanks for talking to us.
Thank you.
Syracuse University Economics Professor Mary Lovely. Professor, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
And Sean Donnan, World Trade Editor at the Financial Times. Sean, thank you.
Thanks so much for having me.
This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. I'm Joshua Johnson. Thank you so much for listening. This is 1A.